And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing conversations with a wide range of people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, and men's and boys' issues. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Tara June Winch, who is the author of a new book called The Yield. Tara is a Wiradjuri author, now based in France. Her first novel, Swallow the Air, was critically acclaimed, and she was named the Sydney Morning Herald Best Young Australian Novelist. She has also won numerous literary awards. Tara wrote the Indigenous dance documentary, Kariburi, which screened at the 71st Cannes Film Festival and is touring internationally. This is a big book. It details the experiences of the fictional Gundawindi family, and these reflect the experiences of all Indigenous people touched by violence, segregation, abuse, and the dehumanising policies and practices of colonisation. Australia had the largest loss of languages of any country in the world. Tara, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Thanks for having me.
So, Tara, languages are important, aren't they? And I noticed the use of your words, some of the places you've named, massacre, poison, Waterhole Creek, although these are actual place names in Australia, aren't they?
Yes. There's a place called Massacre in Queensland, Poison Waterhole Creek in New South Wales. Yeah, they're legacies of the horror of our history. Mm. And I used those names. I took Massacre and made it Massacre Plains in where the story set, just to show that, you know, there's still evidence on the land of our history.
And really, I suppose it's a big theme of the book, isn't it? Because you have sections with Aboriginal language, and then at the end of the book you've got the dictionary that Albert Gundawindi was actually making.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a structurally complicated novel in a sense, but I wanted to really write a story about Australia as a whole and for many years, and I think that's why it took me so long, because my focus was too wide. And so when I focused in on making that physical space smaller, I focused in on 500 acres of rural land along a fictional river, which is based on the tributaries of the Murray-Darling Basin. And the story is told through three narrative strands, two of which are male narrators who are looking back at the end of their lives and wanting to tell their truth.
You're now based in France. Did it give you a new perspective looking back at the country from overseas like that?
I was coming back and forth and going out to, I had a little room at a writer's house in Wagga Wagga. And so I was coming back and doing research throughout the, you know, last 14 years. So I had my notes, but there were times that I was writing in France and, you know, I couldn't remember the exact, I knew the sound of the bush, but I just needed to hear it again in order to describe it. And so I had to resort a lot of times to watching YouTube, actually. There's a lot of amateur bird watchers that put up, you know, four-hour-long videos just filmed in the bush, and I'd just watch them and try and evoke that sense that I was still there.
Probably. Did you burn a few leaves while you were watching the YouTube? Give the upright atmosphere. Well, yes, I mentioned before about the loss of languages. Do you have any figures on how many of the Indigenous languages we've now lost?
Very vague for me, but over 600, the figure is over 600 existed at the time of colonisation. There's about 250 languages that are still alive in one way or another today.
You're a Wiradjuri woman. Is the Wiradjuri language, it's still alive?
It's alive because of a lot of elders, in fact, but two main people in particular, one of which is Dr. Uncle Stan Grant Sr. and a linguist named Dr. John Rudder, who revitalised the Wiradjuri language and actually created a very slim dictionary in 2003 or 2002, and since then have continued to work with community to build on that language. And it's a language brought back from sort of the brink of extinction. Mm-hmm. fascinating work that's done. It's incredible.
Dr. Stan Grant, who you mentioned then, is the senior, is the father of the journalist we all know, Stan Grant. And I've heard Stan Grant Jr. saying that his father was once arrested in the main street of town for speaking his original language.
Incredible.
When you hear the stories like that, you think maybe we have advanced a little bit. But, well, it's fantastic that with that background that, yes, he's now done so much work in preserving that Wiradjuri language.
Oh, it's amazing. And so I actually just took that as inspiration. So when I was researching my first novel, which was back in 2004, 2005, I'd drive out to Nurumbang, which is the Wiradjuri word for country, Wiradjuri land, and I did a one-day language course out at Wagga Wagga and bought the dictionary and used about four words, end up making it into Swallow the Air. For example, a word called Bila, which means river in Wiradjuri. And after Swallow the Air came out, the experience of having that dictionary and learning a few words was so moving for me. It made me feel connected to a culture that was broken. And I knew that I wanted to incorporate more language into the next work that I would do. So the idea's been there that long. I just didn't know it was going to take, 15 years to bring the book out.
Yes, that's an extraordinary length of time, and I congratulate you because it's a fantastic book, and it's also a reference book with all those words that you've included in the dictionary. Do you feel you could sort of get by speaking Wiradjuri now?
Oh, not at all. I've been studying for my French citizenship test, so there's been so much French in my mind, but now I've got the novel as a reference book and, of course, the Wiradjuri dictionary from Stan and John. I've got something to refer to continue that work. But it's so important, language, in connecting with culture and connecting with country. It's important on a few levels, especially as a tool for rehabilitation and mental health work. And I had that in mind when I was writing this book. Another person that was inspiring me was Joe Williams, who wrote a great memoir called Defying the Enemy Within. I'm not sure if you know that one.
Well, I'm very glad you mentioned that because we interviewed Joe about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, he's fantastic, and he's a Wiradjuri man. But he talks about, during his struggles with his mental health, that the healing balm for him was connecting with his culture again, and which included his language. Because if we don't belong somewhere, we're not connected, it can cause, obviously, depression, feelings of lack of self-esteem, self-worth, suicidal tendencies. It's really essential work, not even just for Indigenous Australians to connect back to their culture, but I believe all Australians, because we live among the oldest surviving civilization on Earth. It's just incredible what we have on our doorstep.
Yes, we have to get that message out there, don't we? Because the young Aboriginal men in particular are going through a really tough time. And if we could somehow get the message out, connect with your culture, do what Joe's done, and, I'm sure the results would be extremely positive if you look at the history of Aboriginal people over 60-odd thousand years.
Yeah, so he's doing incredible work on community, as you probably know from 2 weeks ago, but around the country with young boys and men. He's a real inspiration for a lot of people and a lot of women too.
Yes, I think people are getting the message, and we might just take a short break now and listen to a song from some non-Indigenous people. This is a band, well-known band called Midnight Oil.
I stole, and tell me why. If I yell at night, there's a reply of blue silence. The screen is no comfort, I can't speak my sentence. They blew the lights at heaven's gate, and I don't know why. But if I work all day on the blue sky mine, they're crossing their fingers, they pay the truth makers. The balance sheet is breaking up the sky. So I'm caught at the junction, still waiting for medicine. The sweat of my brow keeps on feeding the engine. Hope the crumbs in my pocket can keep me for another night. And if the blue sky mining company won't come to my rescue, if the sugar refining company won't save me, who's gonna save me? Who's gonna save me?
We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.
And that was Midnight Oil singing Blue Sky Mine. And we're speaking today with Tara June Winch, who is the author of a new book called The Yield. Tara, in your book, it's set in the present, and there are a lot of current issues, like you talk about coal seam gas, and you talk about mining. In this case, it's tin mining. But this is a reflection of the experience of all Indigenous Australians who have been touched by those sorts of issues. Do you see some lessons there in how the Aboriginal people should respond when they get confronted with the miners?
I mean, it's important to remember that everyone has their own country and their own community, and at the end of the day, it's their prerogative and their choice what to do with their country. So it's just me writing this book was sort of my beliefs, I guess. I tried not to be dogmatic in it. I tried to make a balanced argument, I think. I mean, I just had so many concerns, of course, over the years. And like I said, I was trying to talk about the whole of Australia, but particularly just for this fictional family.
Well, you've included a character, Auntie Nikki, and also Eddie Falstaff. And Eddie and Auntie Nikki are effectively working against the rest of the Gundawindi family, aren't they, in sort of doing what they can to promote the mine rather than promote country for the Indigenous people.
Right, but every novel needs some villains. And I think, I mean, as all of us in society, we always have villains among us. So that was just to balance everything out.
It's shocking when you're confronted with some of the past. I mean, at one stage you quoted, I think it was a sign, and it said, "Think white, act white, be white." Once again, I think I sincerely hope we've moved beyond that in modern Australia.
Yeah, it's a complicated issue, but every reference towards violence to what happened in the boys' and girls' homes that are talked about, every issue that came up at missions and stations that's noted in the book, it all came from fact. I sort of wanted to write a fiction book that was steeped in fact, because they're the types of books I like myself.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a lot to be learnt. I also liked one part where you say sometimes there isn't a silver lining, and perhaps we assume that there are going to be silver lining in things like the stolen generation, when in fact there probably wasn't a silver lining at all.
Right. That's what I believe. Mm. But I tried to, because we've got the three narrative threads, we've got Poppy Albert Gondawindi opening the novel, and his death is imminent, and he decides he wants to tell his story of himself, his family, his people, his history. And so he tells that through the dictionary, and it's all based on those, coming back to those 500 acres. And then there's the voice of his granddaughter who's coming back for her grandfather's funeral, for Poppy's funeral. And so she's, that voice is told in the third person action that's happening in the novel, dealing with the mine, all these issues that are coming up from the past and how they affect people today, still today, in her family and in her circle of her community. And then that third narrative strand is Reverend Greenleaf, who founded the mission in 1880, all those years before, on that same 500 acres. And he's also reflecting at the end of his life as a German who is an enemy of the state in 1915. He's reflecting on his influence and the right things he did, the wrong things he did, you know, what he, his idealistic sort of view of what he was doing as a missionary, and realizing at the end of his life when this kind of discrimination happens to him against his mother tongue, which is German, he realizes the impact then of denying the missionary residents their native tongue. And I needed to have the Reverend as this, I needed the reader to question whether he was good the whole way through the novel. Because there are those pockets of society in Australia where they believe that it was for their own good. And I wanted to show that, okay, let's look at him idealistic, question him. But I wanted to say, even if you believe that idea, which is a wrong idea, even if you did, it still turned out bad. The result is still a huge horror and a tragedy for Aboriginal people in Australia.
Yes, you've got that, the range of characters, because Albert Gundawindi, who's the, I guess, the patriarch, and as you say, where the book starts, I mean, he's really good at every level, isn't he? He seems to be somewhat an idealistic type person that everyone could, as likes to aspire to.
I think so. I really like him. He was sort of, his voice was based off my grandfather's and also my father's voice, but also that internal voice, I think, that we all have inside us that tells us the good things to do, the right things to do in life, how to live a good life. And whether we listen to that voice or not, I feel like Albert Poppy Gundawindi is the embodiment of that.
Now, you mentioned there are a number of aunties, and there are great aunties in the story. For us non-Indigenous people, would you be able to explain the role of an auntie? Because it's always sort of fascinated me, the role of aunties in Aboriginal families.
The aunties in the family are judgmental and loving and soft and hard and complicated. And I've just based them off some of my relatives, who shall not be named. But there's a playfulness in the care of the aunties in the novel. Yeah, and the aunties are important because they're just as important as the mother and the grandmother there for young August, the character in the book. They're there to guide her, essentially.
So they're a resource if, for whatever reason, the mother's not available. In this case, the mother in the family is in jail, which is all too frequent an occurrence at the moment. But the aunties are there, aren't they, to be the backup?
Yeah, absolutely.
And look, while you're explaining things, we often hear about the link between Aborigines and the land, and you've named the house where they come from, the home property, Prosperous. Is that sort of illustrative of that link between the Aboriginals and the land?
Oh, well, Prosperous was named by the missionary, so it was, you know, it was an idealistic name. I don't know, it just came to me. It's funny when you're writing that you sometimes, you know, names or even the title of the novel just sort of dropped into my head, and sometimes you have a reaction and instinctual feeling that is the right path to take. Yeah, I don't know. Prosperous is, I guess it was just playing a little, it was a little bit ironic. And, you know, when you read the novel, the Reverend reflects on naming the place Prosperous as well.
Yeah.
And the consequences of that, of living in the shadow of wanting prosperity and what prosperity is for each person.
Well, the title of the book, The Yield, it's It's a positive expression. Do you think there is a positive message from your book?
I hope so. I think, oh goodness, it's very difficult as a writer to explain exactly what it is at the end of it, to look back and say, yeah, I made those decisions while I was writing, and that's exactly how I envisaged it to turn out, and everyone who reads it should interpret it the same way. But at its essence, I think it is hopeful. It's hopeful for a future Australia. When I'm talking about the book and talking to other linguists and people who work in language centres and educators, I'm getting more and more excited about the idea of all of us learning Indigenous languages in some way or another, starting with, you know, early education. There are programs that are in preschools at the moment called Ella, and it's a sort of iPad program where 2-, 3-, 4-year-olds are able to learn, you know, a second language, be it French or Italian or Mandarin. And I don't see why, maybe I'm idealistic, why we can't incorporate Indigenous language into that program and into curriculum all over the country. It's basically creating, in my mind, a viable economy, because you're then creating positions for teachers and trainers to work on the language, to revitalise language, learn the language, to then teach students. And so you're creating jobs that are actually about continuing culture in the same time.
You point out at some part of the book that it's like a matter of courtesy. If you go to a foreign country, like you go to France and you learn French, and yet that seems to have slipped by in Australia. But maybe we will get to the stage where, we learn Aboriginal languages as a courtesy to the local people when we go into Aboriginal country.
Absolutely. Like, it's one of the things I've always done. I've travelled a lot overseas. And before I leave, while I'm packing, I'm picking up a few words in the local language of the country I go to. And you do that for two reasons. One, it's very practical. But the other reason is really important, is it's respectful. And all Australians, when they realise that we're on someone else's country, wherever we live in Australia, whatever our colour or creed, we're on someone else's country. And isn't that the right thing to do, to be respectful enough to learn some of the words, the first words?
I think you're absolutely right. And we're speaking today with Tara June Winch, who is the author of this new book called The Yield. And I congratulate you, Tara. Your book has been described as a celebration of what was, what endures, and is a powerful reclaiming of Indigenous language, storytelling and identity. I don't think I could sum up any better than that. Tara, we've reached the stage of the show where we ask our guests if they'd like to pick a song. Would you like to tell us what direction you've gone on that?
Oh, you can pick anything from Archie Roach's Charcoal Lane, because I listened to that on loop while I was writing this book.
A great reference for this. This is a song called Mullywonk by Archie Roach.
Standing on this mountain, see how far we come. I see my brothers and sisters still falling down. Looked across this river, this is where we wanna be. Cried all our salty, salty tears into the sea. And the voice of the Mullywonk is calling. Yeah, the voice of the Mullywonk is calling. Ruby left the river, cried so bitterly. She was born by the water's edge, underneath this tree. She come back to the river and cried so happily, 'cause she no longer a stranger in her own country. And the voice of the Muyo Wonk is calling. Hear the voice of the Muyo Wonk is calling.
Was Muyowonk by Archie Roach. It was a love song written by Archie to his long-term partner Ruby. We'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website dadsontheair.com.au and send us an email, and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. So it just remains for me now to give a very special thank you to our guest, Tara June Winch. Tara, thank you very much for being a guest on Dad's on the Air.
Thanks for having me once again. Thank you.
And we wish you all the best with this wonderful book. So don't forget, we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.